Joshua chapter 5, beginning in verse 1. So it was when all the kings of the Amorites who were on the west side of the Jordan, and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea, heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan from before the children of Israel until we had crossed over, that their heart melted, and there was no spirit in them anymore because of the children of Israel. At that time the Lord said to Joshua, "Make flint knives for yourselves and circumcise the sons of Israel again the second time." So Joshua made flint knives himself and circumcised the sons of Israel at the heel of the foreskins. And this is the reason why Joshua circumcised them. All the people who came out of Egypt who were males, all the men of war, had died in the wilderness on the way after they had come out of Egypt. For all the people who came out had been circumcised. But all the people born in the wilderness on the way that they came out of Egypt had not been circumcised. For the children of Israel walked 40 years in the wilderness till all the people who were men of war who came out of Egypt were consumed, because they did not obey the voice of the Lord, to whom the Lord swore that he would not show them the land which the Lord had sworn to their fathers that he would give us, a land flowing with milk and honey. Then Joshua circumcised their sons whom he had raised up in their place, for they were uncircumcised because they had not been circumcised on the way. So it was when they had finished circumcising all the people that they stayed in their places in the camp till they were healed. Then the Lord said to Joshua, "This day I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you." Therefore the name of the place is called Gilgal to this day. Now the children of Israel encamped in Gilgal and kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month at twilight on the plains of Jericho. And they ate the produce of the land on the day after the Passover, unleavened bread and parched grain on the very same day. Then the manna ceased on the day after they had eaten the produce of the land, and the children of Israel no longer ate manna, but they ate the food of the land of Canaan that year. And it came to pass when Joshua was by Jericho that he lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, a man stood opposite him with a sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said, "Are you for us or for our adversaries?" So he said, "No, but as commander of the army of the Lord, I have now come." And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshiped and said to him, "What does my Lord say to his servant?" Then the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, "Take your sandal off your foot, for the place where you stand is holy." And Joshua did so. That might seem like a strange reading, but I'd like for you to consider a couple of things with me this morning. I know it seems like a very strange topic that you see on the board. I need a theophany. Bob got it a while ago to put on the thing, and he couldn't even pronounce it, much less tell me what it was. What is a theophany? I had to pick on you, Bob. What is a theophany? You've heard of an epiphany. A theophany is, in fact, we sang the song, the very first song was called Theophany. So did you even know what you were singing? And as you listen to the words of that song and go back and think about the words of that song, it's really talking about the idea of a vision that you have of God. The idea of the Latin term theo is God, and the phineas is how you pronounce the second part of that in Latin. And it just means an appearance, a vision, something you see. And so it's a seeing or sighting of God. It comes down to man. God reveals himself to man, and you can see that in the story that we see here with Joshua. And there's a number of other theophanies that are found in Scripture, and we'll point those out in just a few moments. But I'd like to start my lesson by simply using this as a title called I Need a Theophany. And you realize right up front that I'm not going to get the same one that Abraham got, or that Joshua got, or that Moses got, or others in the Scriptures. But I'm simply saying it from the angle of, sometimes I need to hear from God. I need to see God. I need to see some type of a sign from God, as it were, that God is involved in my life and in the lives of the world. I'll tell you where this first came up. in a most striking, stark way. There's just some issues in this world that have got my attention. They've gripped me, and I am consumed by them. And I become very worried, and I lose confidence many times because of these particular issues in my life. And one of them, they both happened in the year 1983. In 1983, Benita brought home a picture of a baby that she was carrying. And it was my baby, too. And this picture, even though I had seen many times pictures of photos of babies in a womb, this was Ryan. This was my firstborn. And all of a sudden, it became a powerful image in my life. That image is still there in my mind. And I see it a lot. I had actually been involved in a right to life since the 1970s. 1973 was the infamous Roe v. Wade decision from the Supreme Court that was brought down that made abortion legal in all 50 states, overriding the states' rights and making it a federal thing. And I looked at that, and it became bothersome to me, and I even talked about it, I preached about it. But I tell you what, when you see the picture of a baby in a womb, and it is your baby, and all of a sudden it becomes so real to realize that this issue, particularly to me, has become so overwhelming that I've gotten very involved in the Texas Right to Life at that time, and then when I moved up here, I've become involved in the Minnesota Right to Life, trying to work and see that we can educate people to understand that what Psalm 139 is saying is that when God has formed David, in this particular case, in his mother's womb and breathed into him life, that there was life from conception. God has said so. And there's so many scriptures that we can refer to on that, where the babe leaped in her womb when Elizabeth tells the story of when Mary comes into her house carrying the Christ child. And we can look at so many others, and it becomes a real thing to us when we realize that this is something that is so crucial, something that is so important. In that same time, though, I got on a plane, and I went overseas for the very first time in my life in 1983. And I'll never forget getting off the plane and stepping out into Manila, the Philippines. I had been in major cities, so-called, in America. I'd been to New York. I'd been to other cities that had a lot of population to them. But I had never experienced what I experienced that day when I walked into that outside the airport into Manila and saw teemingly millions and millions of people. It was one of the most populated countries in the world per square mile. And in Manila itself, in fact, in the Tala district of the Philippines, is the most condensed population in the entire world. Over 1 million people live within 3 square miles. If you can kind of picture that. And I preached there. And it just overwhelmed me, the idea of souls and what souls really did look like to God, looking at the millions and millions of people that need to be saved. It overwhelmed me. And it gets me to where I'm always thinking about things like this. All of us have particular issues that we deal with in our lives. We wish we could just, with a snap of the finger, make it all right, make it all real and be true and honor God. But there's a lot of things I can't do. And that's why I need a theophany. That's why I need to hear from God. I need to be able to experience God in my life, to know that He sees what I see, and He's more concerned about it than I am by any stretch of the imagination. He cares for those souls so much that He sent His Son to take care of that issue. But He also cares about those babies as well. And so when I think about that, I need a theophany. And I used Joshua's story to kind of remind us of that. Joshua, of course, going back 40 years before this, he would have been up on that mountain. He traveled part way up. And Moses went on to the top, and he experienced his theophany when he comes to this burning bush, and God speaks to him out of the bush and tells him these things. And then later on in the experience, in a few chapters later in Exodus, after Exodus 3, we come to Exodus 33, and Moses comes after all this back and forth with God all this time, and he finally says to God, God, you put a burden on my shoulders. I don't know what to do with all these people. How am I going to deal with this? And he simply says, God, show me your glory. Show me you. Give me a theophany, God. And God, of course, says, I'll make my goodness pass before you. I'll put you into the cleft of the rock, put my hand over you and pass by, and you can see the backside. But you cannot see me and live. Moses had his, but he would obviously tell that story to Joshua. And Joshua then has his theophany 40 years later that we've just read in Joshua chapter 5. Now, what I want to do is pick up the story there and talk a little bit about that. But before I do, I want you to kind of know where I'm coming from. In 2 Corinthians 10 is a passage that I go to all the time when I go through my anxieties, when I go through my worries about whether it be babies or whether it be lost souls or a few other issues that I deal with in my life and that you deal with in yours as well. And I'm reminded of this passage often. I've just made it part of my go-to verses in the Scriptures. When it says, for the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but they're mighty in God for the pulling down of strongholds, casting down arguments and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. Man, do I need that. That I need to realize that God sees things that I don't see. He cares more about them than I'll ever care about them. Whether it be those souls or whether it be those babies or whatever it might be, then know that the weapons of my warfare, and that's what I often want to do. I want to take matters into my own hands and just resolve these issues, take care of these things, make them right. And God's reminding me, the weapons of our warfare are not carnal. I need to take every thought into captivity to Christ. I need to make whatever the Bible says real to me, that God's up there and He sees more than I see and He's doing something about it. And that, of course, leads to what we just sang, even though you didn't realize when it says, wait, wait, wait on the Lord. You know where that's found? It's found in Psalm 37. That whole song, in fact, is found in Psalm 37. And when you talk about it, where he's talking here about, David is talking in this psalm about the problems in his life, and he's trying to figure them out and deal with them, and he's basically needing God, and he's basically saying, God, I need you right now. And then he writes this passage after realizing that God does see and know and care, and he says, look, trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and feed on His faithfulness. Feed on God's faithfulness. God sees, knows, and cares. And then he says, delight yourself in the Lord. And then he says, commit your way to the Lord, trust in the Lord, rest in the Lord, wait on the Lord. David's just going over and over and over again this whole idea that he says, I get impatient, God. I want things to happen now. I want to resolve these issues in my life now. And I need to realize that God is doing something about it. And he's saying to me, David, just stop. Hush, sit down. I got this. It's not in your time frame. It's not in your time scale. But I've got this. And you think about maybe all the issues that David had in his life. At the end of his life, he could look back and he could realize God did take care of them in his own way, in his own time. And I need to do the same thing in my life with whatever issues are going on in my life. Isaiah 40 is one that I go to a lot. We sing about it. We talk about it. Even the youth shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. But those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. That's a passage in Isaiah 40 talking about so many other issues going on in Isaiah's life, particularly idolatry that's going on. And he's saying, God, we need to take care of this. God, this needs to be resolved. And God's saying, I'm taking care of it in my own time. And it might take generations for God to finally resolve those issues, but they got resolved in God's time and in God's way. What does that mean? Well, we'll go back to our story and remember what we just read a few moments ago. And I want you to be thinking about whatever you're anxious about, whatever your issues are, whatever the things that you are trying to deal with in your life. and realize as you look at the story of Joshua, you remember that they have been 40 years moving in this direction. They've even fought some battles on the Transjordan side to get to the point of the Jordan River, to where then God opens the Jordan River like he had opened the Red Sea and allowed Moses across and Joshua as well 40 years previous. And now God has told the priest to step into the water and the waters divide up. They walk across and now here they are in Gilgal. Here they are finally in the promised land, the long-awaited 40-year journey into the promised land. 400-year journey actually into the promised land considering they made it to Abraham. And after they crossed over, the enemy is within sight. The Bible tells us in verse 1 that all the kings of the Amorites and all the kings of the Canaanites, their hearts melted. There was no spirit anymore in them. They were dispirited. They were terrified of this Jehovah and the God of Israel. And they just were almost about to melt away. And now you can almost imagine when Joshua has his war council, he gathers all of his generals, his colonels around him. And he says, okay, guys, what are we going to do now? And the war council would be, okay, we strike because their hearts are melted. It's the time to strike. This is the time to do this. And I'm sure Joshua is probably agreeing. He's a man of action. He wants to get this thing done. Let's get this on the road. And God comes along and he says, I want you to come up to my war room. I want you to listen to my counsel. And here's what I want you to do. I know you're excited and all your army is ready to march, but here is what you need to do. Need to back off, and we're going to take weeks before we ever go into battle. And I'm sure Joshua's going, what? Why? Why? We're ready to go. And he says, no, first things first. Notice what he does. He says, it's not time to strike now because we've got to deal with the spiritual before we deal with any of the physical. And so God's way is coming along, and he's saying, here, let's do it this way. First, there's going to be this thing called circumcision. So the first step, Joshua, before you get on your battle armament, before you put on your fatigues and go into battle, I want you to do this. I want you to take a flint knife, and I want you to circumcise the entire male population of Israel. Yeah, the previous generation had been circumcised, but this generation has not. And that's the sign of the covenant, and you need to do this. And so he takes from verses 2 all the way down to verse 9, and he circumcises these people, these men, and then he has to have time for the healing of it. And they all are willing to go through this because they realize this is the sign of the covenant going all the way back to Abraham. Something they haven't been practicing for 40 years now. But then he says, now, here's what else we got to do. We got to observe the Passover. So in verse 10 he says, now we're going to take time. Now that the healing has taken place and we've gone through weeks of that, and now we're going to do the Passover. And so he waited all the way to the 14th of the month to take the Passover. And after they finish the Passover, they have that spiritual restoration, the relationship, fellowship with God once more. And you think, okay, now we can go. He says, not so fast. Now we're going to eat a meal. We're going to eat a different kind of meal than you've been eating for the last 40 years. And so I promised you in the land of promise, there was the land flowing with milk and honey and corn and wine, and we had the grain and all those things that are out here. We're going to eat of the produce of the land. So now they even take time to go out and just prepare meals and have a meal together. And they do that, and on that particular, in fact, the next day after they ate that, God finally quit sending the manna and the quail that he had been sending for 40 years. He had been feeding them miraculously for 40 years, and now he says, no, I promised you this promised land. Now it's before you. Now you're going to have to do what I say in order to eat. You're going to have to fight the Lord's battles. But then he says, before we do that, there's one more thing. I'm not sure if he told Joshua to do this, but we know Joshua did it. Joshua took time to go to Jericho, a few miles away from Gilgal, and to survey the land, to look it over and to see what is before us. And so like Nehemiah, when he was sent, he went the night journey trying to figure out how to build the walls back and look how all the breaches thing, and he had to figure all that out. Joshua was doing the same thing. He's looking at a battle plan, and I'm not sure exactly when he was told this, but he's going here and he's looking at it. He says, now how are we going to breach those walls? Jericho was one of the monster cities of that day, and no doubt the walls would have been massive, and it looked like we had fought battles previously on the Transjordan side, but they were face to face, they were army facing army, and we could fight those kind of battles, but we've never fought a walled city before. How are we going to deal with this? And so he's trying to figure that all out. And he's thinking, man, this burden that's on his shoulders has got to be unbelievable. So he's looking at this need for a prospect, and all of a sudden, verse 13 tells us, a man. A man shows up. A man comes to him here probably in the night, and he walks up to him, and he's holding a sword. And here's this man holding a sword, and Joshua, being a military guy, is looking at him, and he's saying, first of all, where'd you come from? You didn't come with me, and all my men are with me. Who are you? And a man holding a drawn sword is either in an offensive or a defensive position. He's either going to come and fight Joshua and his army, or he's going to defend Joshua and his army. Joshua's not sure because he's only one man standing there. Who are you? What do you want? Are you for us? Are you against us? And so he's trying to figure this out. And Joshua then has his, what we call his theophany. He says to him in reply, neither. I'm not for you or against you in that respect, as far as being on in your army. I'm here to tell you, you're going to be in my army. You're not the commander. You're not the captain of this army. I want you to know that I am the commander of the Lord of hosts. You're coming to fight with me. You're not the general, you're the colonel. I'm the general, and you're going to fight with me. And we're going to win this war. We're going to win this battle. Joshua wasn't expecting this, but again, going back in time, he would have understood there were these, I call them Christophanies. They were appearances of Jesus Christ. And I believe that's who this is, and I think that the context demands that that's the case. When we look at, like in Genesis 32, when Jacob, remember when he was fighting, he was wrestling with this character, and the Bible says, he says, your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel. When he asked him, well, who is your name? And he goes, why are you asking me my name? But he says, your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel, for you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed. And what we see here is probably some type of an appearance of Jesus Christ to Jacob to wrestle with him and to mess up his hip, but also then to remind him that I am here with you. And so don't worry about your meeting with Esau and all the things in the future. I'm here with you. I've given you a promise. But we also remember the story of the three Hebrew boys that were there in Nebuchadnezzar's situation where he says, I want you to, when I blow the trumpet, to bow down to me. And they said, no way. We're not going to bow down to you. And they finally came back and he says, look, after he throws them into this fire that had been heated up seven times, and he thinks, okay, they're going to burn up, and he looks in there, and there's not just even three guys in there, there's four. And he yells out, he says, look, I see four men loose walking in the midst of the fire, and they're not hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. Was that Jesus Christ? I think probably it was. It was some type of an image, maybe an angel from God, but whatever the thing, he's calling the Son of God in this regard. Daniel, being inspired, would have put that in there. So I look at that and I say, what is it that Joshua is seeing? When it says, and Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshiped. Here's why I say it was a theophany or a Christophany, if you please, to say it was a deity. Because you cannot worship angels. We know in Revelation, the Bible would tell us in Revelation chapter 19 and verse 10, if you fall down like John fell down before an angel, he says, no, you stand up, you worship God. You don't worship angels. We're created beings like you are. And so when I think about Joshua falling down before this being and he accepts the worship, it has to be a theophany. It has to be a God. It has to be God who he's falling down before. Otherwise, he'd be reproved and told to be corrected on that. And so what he says in response to that, when he realizes when he falls down to worship this commander of the Lord's army, and we know that to be Jesus Christ, most likely. And he says to him, what does my Lord say to his servant? In other words, what we see of Joshua, He's worried. He's got this burden on the whole world down on his shoulders. He's leading an army for the first time into the promised land. He knows the Amorites and the Canaanites and all these ites that are out there are going to be massive. They're going to be very difficult for his ragtag army that just came out of the wilderness to be able to fight these organized armies. And he's worried about that. How am I going to do all this? And he comes down and God has to remind him in this case, I got this. What does my Lord say to his servant? In other words, he's saying, this is the Lord's battle. Joshua, this is not yours. This is mine. And I'll tell you something. When I think about my issues that I relayed to you a few moments ago, and you think about the ones that you're dealing with, it might be family, it might be a marriage, it might be with parent-child relationships, it might be other things, it might be the election, it might be whatever it might be that you're struggling with right now. I need to come to the grips with the idea that God's going to be there for me. God sees things that we don't see. He understands and cares for them far more than I do. And I need to learn, as we said in Psalm 37, to wait on the Lord, to trust in the Lord. And He'll make it right. He'll take care of this. So then the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, take your sandals off of your foot, for the place where you stand is holy. And Joshua did so. And of course, you recognize that he would have known that to be the story going back 40 years when Moses was told that very same thing. So he has this flashback, as it were, and he says, oh, I remember that you spoke to my master Moses, who I was his assistant. And Moses came down from the mountain, and the first thing he probably told Joshua was, you should have seen what I saw, and you should have heard what I heard. I saw in the presence of God. And now Joshua is feeling the same thing as he takes over Moses' mantle and now begins to wear it for the leading into the promised land. The commander of the Lord's army says those things. So when the Lord of hosts fights, I want you to think with me just for a moment before we close. I want you to think about the story of Elisha's vision. Remember, you all know that story, that he had gone into Dothan and he and his servant were there and the king was out trying to find him. They finally tracked him down. They said he's in Dothan. So he brings his army and he completely surrounds the city. The servant gets up early in the morning, comes out, looks over the wall, and as he sees over the wall a massive army that they're there to get them, he's terrified and he runs back and he tells his master Elisha, the armies are outside, we're in trouble. And Elisha, with almost a smile on his face, I'm sure with a pat on the shoulder, saying, now, settle down. And he says to him, do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them. And then he makes this prayer, Lord, open his eyes that he might see what I see. And he opened his eyes and he began to see the chariots of God surrounding the armies of man. That those armies didn't have a chance when God was involved. And I'll tell you, that's a powerful vision that we need to remember. When Christ comes along in Matthew 26 and they're worried about here comes the armies marching out to arrest him and to take him and to lead him away. And Peter pulls the sword and says, I'll do something about this. And the Lord says, put your sword up. Don't you know that if I have the power to call 12 legions of angels down from heaven and deal with this? God's got his plan and we're going to live within his plan. And his plan is that I must die. But there's one more that I want you to think about. It's a passage that confuses me. It's a passage that I don't understand. I cannot explain it to you. But the Bible says it, and so I accept it. And that is, are they not all talking about angels? Are they not all ministering spirits sent forth to minister to those who will inherit salvation? I can't even begin to explain that verse to you, talking in Hebrews 1 about Christ's superiority over angels. He just made mention of that in the brief. He finishes that chapter by simply making that quote. And I've always scratched my head over that quote. What does that mean? That God has sent angels as ministering spirits to care for those who are Christians. I don't even know what that means. But I, by faith, accept whatever God says to be true. Does that mean that I have my own guardian angel? As many bones as I've broken and as many problems I've had in my life, he's doing a very poor job, sort of like, you know, Clarence, you know. Mine hadn't earned his wings yet. But the idea is that when you look at that, I don't know what God is doing in heaven, but I do know that I must wait on the Lord. whether it's the issue, whether it's abortion, whether it's the issues of saving of souls, whatever it might be, whatever I'm worried about, whatever my concerns are, I need to know that God's in heaven and He's got the entire angelic host at His disposal to send down and help. And I must accept that and take that. Joshua, of course, looking at his memory, goes back and realizes what he saw in Moses. But I want you to think about a battle cry that David had. And this becomes my battle cry and the reason I preach this sermon. When David said to the Philistines, you know, when he stands before Goliath and he says, oh, you are just making mockery of my God. And I want you to know, you uncircumcised Philistine, that my God can beat up your God. Let's put Jehovah against Dagon, not just David against Goliath, and let's see who wins that epic battle. And we already know how that turns out. And the point that he's then making is saying, I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts. The commander of the Lord of hosts, the commander of the Lord's army is the point being made. He goes on to say that all this assembly shall know that the Lord does not save with sword and spear. The battle is the Lord's. And it's so hard for me sometimes to come to grips with and accept that I want to get this thing done. I want to do it in my lifetime. And a lot of these things are not going to be resolved in my lifetime. But God says, Rick, I want you to serve me in your generation doing what you can, whether it's to save babies or to save souls. I want you to know that I've got this. The battle is the Lord's. And I need that theophany. I need to be reminded of that regularly, that I am just nothing more than a foot soldier in the Lord's army. That I'm not in charge, that God's got this. How do you feel about it? Let's go back to our last statement, then we'll close. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God for the pulling down of strongholds. Think of Joshua standing before Jericho, this stronghold, this massive city. How in the world are we going to knock those walls down? How are we going to get inside? He had no idea how he's going to do it. But God gave him the battle plan. He says, here's what I want you to do. Each day I want you to get up. I want you to quietly march around the city. Do that day 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. And on the seventh day, what I want you to do is I want you to march down and I want you to march around 7 times. Then here's what I want you to do. Then I want you to take those trumpets and I want you to blow those trumpets, Joshua. Then I want you to shout. Shout loud and long. I'm sure Joshua's thinking, that's a battle plan? Never heard of that one before. But I trust you, God. The battle is the Lord's. And he does just that, and you know the story. The Lord told Joshua to go to Jericho and to march 7 times around. He followed faithfully the blessed Lord's command, and the walls came tumbling down. My walls, whatever they might be, will come tumbling down in God's good time. If it's God's will that it be done, it will be done. I am but a foot soldier in the Lord's army. Whatever my issue is and whatever your issue is, we need to learn to wait, wait, wait on the Lord. How do you feel about it? Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that He will exalt you in due time, casting all of your cares upon Him, for He cares for you. God sees, He knows, and He cares. And I need to learn to wait on the Lord. Take your shoes off. Not here. Take your shoes off in your mind's eye. Fall down before God and say, as Joshua said to him, speak, Lord, your servant hears. I am your servant. You are the commander. And I relinquish all command to you. And God took care of Jericho, and God takes care of all other issues in our lives if we'll but put our faith and our trust in Him. Our invitation song is, Saints, Lift Up Your Voices. And if we can in any way encourage you in your midst of your